This season, we'll be further exploring each topic, hanging out with experts and enthusiasts of all kinds for more strange stories, social commentary, and the myths that make America tick. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith. Carmen Maria Machado is the author of three books, the award-winning Her Body and Other Parties, a collection of vibrantly haunting short stories that can lead to cathartic, contemplative sobbing, and In the Dream House, a best-selling, heart-wrenching memoir and examination of queer relationship abuse, and most recently, a horror story in the form of a graphic novel called The Low, Low Woods. We could not be more stoked, because here at American Hysteria, we each consider Carmen to be one of the greatest writers of our time. She's also taught several courses at the University of Pennsylvania, most relevant today, a fiction course called The Art of Haunting. Today, we are a little overly excited to talk about haunted house motifs in American horror movies, the emotional core of these stories, and our own personal experiences with various kinds of ghosts, both the creepy ones and also the oddly, mercifully beautiful ones. We are here with Carmen right now, and we are so excited to have her. We're also here with Miranda, our producer. She's going to be contributing to this episode because we've been watching two ghost movies a night for the last 2 weeks, or well, 1 week, I guess, to be fair. So we're going to talk today about haunted houses and all kinds of themes in the paranormal, in horror movies. So hello, Carmen. Thank you for being here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hello, Miranda.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for thanking me. Okay, so we're going to just dive right in. And Carmen, could you talk a little bit about your background with the horror film and particularly the paranormal haunted house motif in horror and ghost stories in general, and kind of how did that interest bloom for you?
So I feel like I have like five origin stories. I'm like a rebooted comic book villain. It always changes a little bit, but a very formative moment for me in my very, very early childhood was so my mother left me with my father when I was maybe 6 or 7. Like, I was pretty young, maybe even 5. I was young. And my mom like left my dad to babysit while she like went to the store or something and came back, and my father had fallen asleep in front of the television and Poltergeist was playing. And I was just sitting with eyes as wide as dinner plates, just staring in absolute terror at the screen. And what's funny about this story is I'd heard this story from my mother, but I never knew what movie, because she didn't know what movie it was. She said it was a scary movie. And then years later, like when I was in my 20s, I lived in Berkeley for a while, and there was this theater nearby that showed like $5 old throwback movies on like Tuesdays. And, you know, you could pay $5 and go see a movie. And so I went with my then boyfriend to go see Poltergeist. I was like, I feel like I've seen Poltergeist, but I'm not sure. And as we were watching it, I had this like vivid, like out of body flashback where I was like, this was the movie. Cause like there were like all these images in my childhood that like returned to me from Poltergeist, like the guy peeling his face off.
Oh my God.
The clown under the bed, the tree coming through the window. That there were all these like images that had sort of plagued me for my whole life. That apparently had come from this movie. And like, I had never seen the movie in a way that I could remember, like pieced together in order. Like, I was like, oh, like it was this very like weird experience. And I was having this like existential crisis. And my boyfriend was just like, what is going on with you? And I was like, you do not understand. Like, I saw this movie at a very formative age. Like, I'm now experiencing it again. So that's like one of the origin stories. The other is that I was just a real scaredy cat, a hypochondriac, and just a terrified child who loved horror and would return to it over and over again. So I really loved, you know, Christopher Pike, R.L. Stine, Lois Duncan, John Bellairs. I don't know if he wrote like The House of the Clock on Its Walls. Like he wrote these like horror novels for children. But I think in like the 60s or 70s, like he was, and I just, I would read these books and would have nightmares and would be up all night. And my mother would just, she would, you know, cause she had to like console me and she, I was exhausted the next day and she would take the books away from me. She would be like, no more of these. Like, and then I would just go to the library and check out more of them, or I would borrow them from a friend. And I was just, and it made no sense because I was just, I would make myself, I would send myself into these like fits of complete hysteria and then would just keep doing it and keep. I also read like medical mysteries and like, you know, as a hypochondriac, and I would read books about kids dying of cancer. So I just, I really was like just a real self-punishing child.
I used to read the synopses of horror movies and I couldn't watch them.
Did you read them in the TV guide? Were you just flipping through the TV guide?
Yes. Like,
yeah, I used to do that too.
Yes.
I'd be like, ooh, that sounds interesting. And I feel like there were all these movies that I saw as a kid that I saw in this exact same way where like it would be like the weird horror movie on like that happened to be on like some channel that would show a lot of horror movies. I saw, I can't remember, it's a John Carpenter movie where it's literally about liquid Satan. Like it's like if Satan, it's a liquid and gets into your mouth and then it'll like turn you into Satan or into a demon or something. I saw that. I saw not the original, but the sequel to the Candyman. So I had seen like Candyman Return to the Flesh when I was like way too young. And, like all these movies that I would catch on TV if I was homesick from school, you know, I would watch them. And so, yeah, I've always just been really drawn, I think, in this very instinctual way to horror. And I had I did an interview a few years ago. It was like one of the first interviews I did for my first book. And I was describing this to the interviewer and he was like, oh, so you like books and work or art that like changes your temperature. And I was like, yes, I think that's an appropriate way to describe it. It like creates, it like provokes, it like creates like an, a, like not a sexual arousal, but an arousal, right? Like a sense of sort of a heightened awareness. And it's like an endorphin rush. I mean, it creates like all these experiences, you know, and also like, I mean, people have studied and talked about how like if you're anxious, like experiencing like a controlled fear, like a roller coaster or a horror movie or something where it's like creating adrenaline, but it's all being done in this like very safe, like it's not real, you know, it's like a very safe environment, et cetera.
It's almost like self-administered cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm no less anxious than I was. I mean, I guess I am because I'm medicated and in therapy, but like, you know, like I'm still a very anxious person, but no. I find horror very like relaxing in this really interesting way that I don't fully understand, which also my wife finds completely unbelievable. She like does not.
That's so funny.
Somebody said horror movies are like salt, which I thought was really interesting. Ooh. Like the way that it changed, the fear is like salt.
I think
so
horror is
the
like
flavor.
So, I think horror itself, not even horror movies necessarily, but like
as a feeling.
Yeah, horror as like a mood. Right. It is like, you're right. It does like create a heightened sense of atmosphere or a heightened sense of the experience. And
that's also like an instinctual. I like to go to the instinctual side of things sometimes because even creepiness, which we've talked about before, is sort of about ambiguity. So if you're feeling the creeps, what you're doing is you're assessing something where you're like, this, I don't know if this is a real threat. So I'm like creeped out because I need to pay hyper attention to what this is to gain more information about it.
The uncanny.
Yeah. So, and I do, yeah, I don't know. I watched It as a kid. That was my favorite, the 1990 It, obviously. And I watch that to fall asleep all the time. So I totally get it. And I know Miranda and I are both very anxious individuals. And maybe it's not going to solve your problems, but you get that catharsis a little bit.
I don't think I fully realized how relaxing I found horror movies until a couple of years ago when I was writing my memoir, which was like a very difficult and personal and emotional experience. And I was in a cabin in the New York, in this upstate New York at this like fellowship. I was alone and I was like just an emotional mess. And I went to sleep every night watching like whatever horror movie I could find. And one night, like, I was like, I saw a movie like on Netflix or something called Truth or Dare. And I was like, oh, I remember watching the trailer for this movie. I'll watch it. And so I started watching it. And like 40 minutes in, I was like, It's so weird. In the trailer for this movie, I remember this like really distinctive thing that kept happening, and it hasn't happened at all. So then I was like Googling, and I was like, oh, there's another horror movie called Truth or Dare that is a similar but not identical premise to this movie, Truth or Dare. So I finished watching the first Truth or Dare, and then I found the other Truth or Dare, and then I watched that one, which is the one that I'd seen the trailer for. And then it was like 1 a.m, and I was like, what is wrong with me? Like, I was
just That's exactly what Chelsea and I have been doing for the last 2 weeks to research these. We're like, oh, Amityville, The Awakening? Great. We've already watched the last two.
We better watch the Bella Thorne one.
Yeah.
This is also how I feel about like the Insidious movies, which are so stupid. Like they are beyond stupid. And every time I watch them, I laugh, which I'm like, this is not the reaction they want me to be having watching this movie. It's so dumb. But it is like, there's something really, it's like eating a potato chip. Like you just can't. I mean, I'm just like, oh, one more. Like, oh, this goes down real easy, you know?
Well, obviously, these things have meaning to us, horror movies specifically. And to bring it back to just specifically the haunted house archetype, the haunting archetype, why is like the most quintessential haunting? You know, we have hauntings in different places. It can happen in a graveyard. It could happen in, you know, some, it could happen anywhere. It can happen at a school. There's so many options. But the quintessential archetype where these hauntings occur is a house. And it may not be abandoned. It can be abandoned. But typically the ones we're talking about is like a family moves into a home and then experiences the paranormal. So why do you think that that is the thing that we return to again and again in these movies?
I mean, I think the home, ostensibly, it's like the place you feel the most comfortable, but also almost always, I mean, not, I guess not always, but often when you live in a home, like you are not the first person to live there. You're either like a renter, there were previous tenants, or like even if as like an owner, like I live in a house, but the house is like 100 years old. So like many people have lived here before me. And so there's something about this idea that like you exist in a space, but this, and the space is yours in like a legal sense, but also like you exist on like land that was stolen, and you exist in a house that like other people lived and died in. And there's this sense of like history. And I think, you know, Americans specifically, like we really struggle with history in a lot of ways because we're a very young country, or at least America itself is a young country. And so, you know, it's weird how like, I don't know, the one time I've like been to Europe, I was in like a bar, and it was like in an old church, and it was like a church was like 1,000 years old or something. It was just something
from like the year 1000. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just like, what? I was sitting like drinking a beer being like, smells like wet stone in here. This is weird.
It's just their normal day in Europe.
Right. Exactly. But I think there's something really interesting because like there is a sense of like history and dimensionality around just like the home as like a place to live. And it's right, ironically, it's like this place where like, you know, you feel safe. Like there's all this history and sort of legacy to the space that I think we don't think about a lot. But then, you know, all it takes is like you finding something weird in a wall or something. And you're like, oh, right. This is like a really old ass house on like old ass land. And like anything could have happened here, you know, and I'm just in it. I'm just marinating in it all day. So I don't know. I feel like houses and spaces like offer us this way of like localizing our thoughts about death and about history and, you know, all the things that we sort of associate with hauntings in general.
Totally. I've been thinking a lot about how like homeownership is tied to the American dream. Mm-hmm. So in these movies, you know, you're sort of having this violation of something that's like ostensibly mine and like, I bought this house and now it's like also where, who was it? Gaston Bachelard said the corners and crevices are where our dreams accumulate. I wrote that down.
Oh, the poetics of space. Yes. That's hot. Oh, that's such a nice deep dive. Oh my God. I literally
poetics of space right here.
And it does have to do with the nuclear family then too, right? Because the nuclear family is the center of the home and also the center of capitalistic democracy. I don't know.
So I teach a haunted house class at Penn, I taught it a couple of years ago. And we read this essay by Jamaica Kincaid that was in the New Yorker in like the 90s. And it was her talking about having bought this home in New York State somewhere. And it was like owned by this sort of minor celebrity in like botany maybe. It was just, he was some like minor scientist, but she had always seen the home and always been very taken with the home. And when it came up for sale, none of his kids, this man died, and none of his children wanted the house. So they came to an agreement and she bought it. And there's this whole sort of thread throughout, because she's not from the United States. And she's like, I know that my kids are Americans because my kids are not going to want this house. Like, adults never live in the houses they grew up in. Americans don't. And so, like, there's this interesting way in which she's sort of talking about, yeah, like, home ownership and, like, the idea of, like, growing up in a space and living in it and taking it. And, like, I mean, it's not really about ghosts, but, like, it's just this really interesting way of thinking about Americans' relationships with, yeah, like, homes, home ownership, like, moving up and moving out and moving to bigger and better things. And it's different than, like, you know, an ancestral home in, like, Europe. Like, there would just be, like, a different way of, like, talking about, like, a home that was, like, sort of inherited through many generations of a family.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a warmer feeling because the mystery isn't there. You can't fill in the mystery of the home.
Well, there still can be plenty of mystery, I think, that's in that true. Sort of setting. But it's just a different way of thinking about it. It's like, I love that joke in oh my God, Knives Out. Did you see Knives Out?
I don't think we did.
Oh my.
Now we will.
Well, you really should, because it's amazing. But there's this very funny joke in Knives Out where, like, basically this rich family is being displaced from their home. It was like this rich guy who died and, like, he didn't give his house to his shitty kids. And they're all really angry. And one of them is like, what? So you're going to kick us out of our ancestral home? And then this other character bursts out laughing and is like, he bought this from, like, some chic in, like, the 80s. Like, this isn't our ancestral home. Like, it looks like a big old mansion, but, like, it didn't belong. It's not, like, from our family, you know. And, like, the weird subtext is that, like, we're Americans, like, we don't do, like, this is not our ancestral home. Like, what the hell are you talking about? So it's just, like, a really interesting idea. And I think there's something, I think Americans, we accept it to be normal to, like, move on to other spaces and, like, occupy new spaces and, like, colonize mm-hmm. new spaces. And that's just mm-hmm. like what we do. And so, like, I think that in many ways, the haunting of spaces is like a sort of expression of that discomfort or the idea of a haunting.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, well, so many haunted house movies are like based in class too, because it's like a rich family moves into a poor community, or a poor family inherits a house or whatever. It's always this divide,
or it's cheap because there was a murder, right? So that's affordable, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
It's
right,
degraded.
Horror, the whole thing in the Amityville Horror is they're like, we couldn't have afforded this otherwise, but because this like gruesome murder took place here, we can actually afford it. And there is like an intense like class element of it. Absolutely, of course.
And also trauma, right? I mean, trauma's got to be a huge, huge part of so much of it, because it can be trauma of your own. Like, you can almost haunt your own space, right? If you're moving into spaces where you've experienced trauma. And there's also the stories of girls sort of creating ghosts with their emotions and their own traumas and different things. Do you think that there's a relationship to trauma in terms of like past hauntings too? Because a lot of times the person has died in a way that is tragic. So it's like, what is haunting exactly?
Right. You know? I mean, I think the thing about hauntings that's so interesting is it's this way in which the past is like asserting itself against the present, right? And that can be trauma. Like, it can be like somebody died here, something horrible happened here. And now the space is sort of irrevocably altered. You know, the space is wounded the way you could wound flesh. Like, you know, it has a scar. Like, there's a psychic disturbance in the house. All of which are actually ideas that, like, there is some, like, sort of biological. Like, they've done, like, studies about, like, if you enter into a space and experience a certain emotion, like, sometimes people walking into that space separately can, like, identify, like, pheromones. Like, there's, like, things that, like, you're giving off. Like, that someone else can perceive, basically.
Whoa, I want to learn everything about that.
Which you cannot be created or destroyed. Yeah.
But, like, there's something also I think about with, like, because also, like, a lot of these movies, and I had forgotten this about Amityville Horror. I was just watching Amityville Horror the other day after we were talking. But, like, Poltergeist has this, Amityville Horror has this, a lot of horror movies have this, which is, like, oh, there was some, like, this was, like, a graveyard or, like, a space. Like, this is, like, a place where, like, an indigenous, like, they don't say indigenous, yep. But, like, an indigenous peoples were that were like displaced in some way, or they're buried here, or like I think Amityville mentions like Salem. I mean, Amityville has like five different explanations for what's happening in the house, but like there's like discussions of like Salem. So like all these like original sins that we committed, though they often miss slavery as an original sin in a lot of these movies. Like, but like, you know, there's like a lot of discussion of like, right, like how we you know, murdered indigenous populations and like displaced them and murdered a bunch of women. Like there's all these ways in which we like are trying to express this idea that like our own history is coming back, but it's not coming back for like us as a society. It's coming back for like these poor people who are just in this one house. Like that's the expression of some terrible misdeed we've done in the past, which I think is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Like visiting the sins of the father upon right, this particular, exactly. You know, I mean, what is it probably, but just an encapsulated microcosm yeah. of America. Yeah. Did you want to talk any more about sort of the Indian burial ground trope? Have you done any work around that or any study around? Yeah.
Not, well, no. And I'm sure there have been like indigenous writers who have written on this with, you know, with sort of specificity. But I do, I mean, we were talking over email about Ghostland, right? And so Colin mm-hmm. Dickey, like in that book, he talks about like this detail about how there was this one place in Virginia where like all the ghosts that were sort of local were white. And he was like, but this mm-hmm. was literally like the port where the most slaves were brought through, like, you know, during that yes, era.
Shackle Bottom.
Right, exactly. And so like, he's like, why is it that like, if the ghosts are about the past, why is it that all of the ghost stories are white when in fact, like the worst human atrocities that we committed in this area were all being done to Black people? So like, yeah. it's again, there's like, even with ghost stories, this discomfort about like articulating what it is. And then there are other ways it manifests too, like the Candyman movies, which is, I mean, about more of a haunted, like a building than like a house, but it's, you know, this idea of gentrification. Like, I mean, there's different ways in which like these sins sort of manifest and then like create these, you know, restless spirits that like then sort of act out violently, which I think is just like a way that we express that discomfort.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There's also, this is definitely prequel to horror movies, but spiritualism as a practice, mm-hmm. we did stuff on spiritualism a while ago. And one of the most fascinating things, there's so much to do with gender and race and different things in the channeling. Mm. So there was a lot of channeling happening, especially women. And that was the only place that a lot of times women could speak because they were speaking for dead men, which is so wild to me.
Wow, that is so on the nose. I love that.
So not only that, but white women most often who were channeling spirits would sometimes channel indigenous spirits or spirits of formerly enslaved people. And those people would give speeches and would forgive the people in the room.
No.
Yeah. So I think back to that. It's not the same thing as the trope, but obviously there's like a guilt issue that's playing out in these different yeah. just really strange and also obviously evasive ways.
Well, because I mean, even with this trope, it sort of suggests that like, oh, don't worry, like this family, this like nice white family is getting punished for like this thing that was done. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't have like an exact theory, but it is the idea of like guilt and forgiveness and like, we feel bad, but we're not going to like do real stuff like policy or like we're just gonna like express right. our discomfort at our past sins through like these horror movie tropes, which I think is very interesting.
We're separating ourselves from it by turning it into a story.
Yeah
So two of the most important movies to me in general for whatever reason are The Shining and Amityville Horror. I saw Amityville Horror as like a 13-year-old on AMC or something. Oh, and I was wow. like, this is my new thing. This is what I'm doing. But I was thinking while we were rewatching those recently about how so often, and I think even I would even say most of the time, hauntings come through a living person. It's very rarely just an entity or a ghost. It has to come through a living person. And that happens to both George Letts and Jack Torrance. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about that and I wanted to ask you about that. And also how The Shining and Amityville were like exact contemporaries. Both the books came out in 77 and then Amityville was 79 and The Shining was 80. But they're basically oh, wow. the same story.
Yeah, a possessed man who attacks his family.
Family annihilator.
And Amityville and The Shining, the axe is also the, which I believe is a phallic symbol of masculinity.
When I was rewatching Amityville, there, like Josh Brolin, like
he's so hot.
He's so hot. I also had that same thought.
So is Margot Kidder.
Yeah, they were very sexy.
They're the hottest couple.
Her cheekbones were like unreal, and his hair, I was like, I run my hands through that hair for hours. Yeah,
we just kept saying it. We kept being like, I don't usually feel like I'm so into a couple in a movie, but oof. All right, that's enough.
I'm like, if they gave me a drink from across the bar, I'd be like super pleased. I'd be like, yep, this is
done. Coming home to the Amityville house.
I would go back. I'd go back to that haunted ass house.
Why not? That's the horror movie we need to make.
That's actually a great premise for a movie. Now I really want to write that movie.
Let's do it.
Did we just accidentally write a great movie premise? That's amazing.
Absolutely. Okay. Anyway.
But yeah, no, there's something. I actually was having that thought because, like, there's that scene where he takes an axe through the door. It's very, like, The Shining, you know. And I noticed that too. I was like, I wonder if Stanley Kubrick had seen it, or, like, if, you know what I mean? Or like, what the relationship between, like, the texts were. Like, I've never read The Amityville Horror, which obviously, like, is, you know, just this, like, weird, like, best-selling hoax book. I agree, they are really similar. I mean, I don't know the history of, like, when we began to sort of understand about family annihilators, like, this idea. I mean, it's weird because in Amityville, the original murder is, like, it's not a father, but it's a son, right? It's, like, the son who kills his parents and, like, all his siblings. But I was having that thought, too. I was like, oh, right, like, what makes him so unsettling is, it's, like, these families in these, like, really isolated settings. The husband is, like, slowly going insane and is, like, doing increasingly violent and terrifying things. I mean, there's, you know, Josh Brolin, like, backhands Margot Kidder. Like, you know, there's just a lot of, like, domestic violence or implications of domestic violence. These, like, families that are sort of slowly being eaten away by, like, madness and isolation. You know, it occurs to me, not to bring it back to my work, but, like,
please.
When I was researching my memoir, like, I was reading about understanding and the evolution of, like, the idea of domestic violence, like, where that, like, because that's about the time when we began to actually acknowledge that domestic violence was a thing. Like, before it was just like, oh yeah, you hit your wife, whatever, that just happens. And it was, like, in, like, the very late 70s, early 80s, when we were like, there's a thing called battery, you know, or there's a thing called, like, wife batter, you know, like, it was very, like, heterosexual and very white and all these things, but there was this way in which we began to articulate that, like, there is a phenomenon when this happens, and, like, we have language for it and, like, talking about how to prevent it and stuff like that. So I wonder if that's actually part of it. It's like, this is a way of, like, art finding that language, you know, alongside, like, the academic, like, sociological conversation about this phenomenon. I'm not sure. I mean, that's just a guess. I don't know.
Totally.
And it's actually really interesting because we are literally talking about The Shining and Amityville as kind of, like, during the time of men's rights, which has a super negative connotation, but originally it was sort of the conversation between women's rights and men's rights and how those are mutually beneficial. But toward the end of the 70s, post-victims rights movement, post-second wave feminism, that of course was very frightening to a lot of men, I think we started to see the focus become these abusers. And I know Stephen King wrote The Shining about his own alcoholism. So I think you're totally on point, and that's totally the same conclusion we were reaching.
I mean, I'm always really interested in the relationship between, like, possession and exorcism movies and haunted house or haunting ghost movies. And there's a lot of overlap. And actually, like, rewatching Amityville, I had forgotten what a big chunk of it is, like, all this priest stuff, like the priest getting ill, the priest, you know, the priest going blind.
And the flies.
The priest covered in flies, like him.
Covered in flies like Mike Pence.
Oh, God, you're right.
I think that was a joke I stole from Miranda when we were watching.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Mike Pence while we watched all the Amityville movies.
Oh, my God. And there's, like, you know, the inverting cross and, like, them, you know, her, the mother praying. And, like, there's just all this religious stuff that I had forgotten.
Portal to hell, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I think that there's something, because I think there are haunted house movies that are closer to, like, a space is actually infused with, like, a presence. Like, the house itself is acting in some way. But there are absolutely variations. There are arguments to be made that, like, it's like, is the house haunted, or is the do you have a deeply unreliable narrator? I mean, with movies, that's a little different because it's, like, a different way. But with prose, like, you know, with fiction, it's like, is the narrator just deeply unreliable, or are we actually experiencing a haunting, right? I feel like there are ones where it's, like, the house itself. I guess technically the others, the house itself is haunted, though it's not clear. It feels like you're experiencing the former the whole time. And what it turns out to be is that the house itself is simply is haunted, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if it's manifesting through one person.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that those do exist. Or like, yeah, but like, I mean, Poltergeist has Carol Ann.
That's what I'm thinking. It's like, it's really hard for me to come up with a movie.
Yeah.
There's at least the person that senses it, right?
Well, it's funny because it's also like a child. It's always like a really, it's like a man who's on the verge of murdering somebody. It's like the first kind. There's like the child with like weird, creepy, because even in the others, like there's the daughter. The daughter is so creepy, right? And has like, there's that whole scene with the veil.
Are you mad?
I am your daughter.
God, that movie is so. Also, I could watch Nicole Kidman scream and have a breakdown literally days. Like, I could never get tired
Does
of it.
Does she do anything else? Like,
good question.
We love you, Nicole.
We love you.
Sometimes she's in Moulin Rouge and she's magnificent.
True, true.
Or she's wasting away physically, but she's also just, like, radiant.
We keep derailing you.
No, I guess you're right. I mean, I guess it's like, I'm sure there are examples of like it not necessarily coming through a person. But I also think that because like that's a way of giving the narrative, like giving the house a kind of voice, right? It's like the human is like the mouthpiece or like the psychological like limb of the house. And it's able to like move around and do things in this way that's like harder. And then also it like adds to it because I think it adds to the threat of like removing the person from the house or like running from the house. Cause it's like if someone's attached to the space, like it makes it more complicated. Cause I feel like a lot of times when you watch me with this, you're like, just move out. What's going on? Like, just leave. Like, what's wrong with you? But there's always something like pulling them back. And I mean, like in Amityville, like the dad, I mean, he goes in after the dog, but it's like he's like the one who can't escape the house, right? Yeah. Like he's the one who. And the house just like sucks him in and just like covers him in that black goo or whatever.
And Harry saves the day.
Yeah, and the dog is just.
Oh. I forgot how like how the dog is just like the absolute hero of that movie. It's beautiful. Yeah.
I always get nervous when a dog appears because I'm like, oh my God.
You know about doesthedogdie.com?
Oh, I do. I consult it often.
It's my most used resource.
Speaking of that force, too, like the house as the force, but also the idea of possession, which is part of the house a lot of the time. Satanic possession, demonic possession, whatever. An entity enters and controls the body of another. And I think that there's something interesting in that it especially seems to possess the father figure. And when I think of it almost as like a separation from the like toxic masculinity as like, okay, so I'm not the person doing this. There's some outside force controlling me to do these bad things. And I think that that kind of reflects it.
It's again, a way of displacing blame. It's like a way of moving the blame away from, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I'm completely taken over by this force, you know, rage or whatever. And I do think that, yeah, I think that's what Stephen King was trying to do.
I feel like possession narratives, which I mean, are not always, but almost exclusively Catholic, Christian or like Catholic in nature, right? It's like this very specific way of thinking about exorcism. And there's always this implication in those narratives that like you invite something in, like so that there's like a weakness, there's like a weak link, you know, somebody doesn't believe in God or like plays with a, you know, does a thing like and you've invited something in. And I think sometimes there's like an interesting distinction between like films in which you have invited this malfeasance to like enter into your home or your body and like create havoc versus like something exists here that's older than you. And it's like, it's not your fault. There's something really, I mean, I don't have like a super developed thought on that, but like I've always been like very curious about these like slight differences between like possession narratives and haunting narratives, even though they are like fundamentally the same, except that like one is about a person being haunted, but obviously like haunted house stories can also have people being haunted. So it's like, they're very similar, but I feel like there's this question of like blame, like whose fault it is for the thing coming is like a really interesting one. And I think the idea that like it's displacing guilt about either like race or displacing guilt about being a man, you know, being a man and being violent or like hitting your wife or whatever.
And they also come to possess, especially post the 70s and into like the Reagan years. These are like morality plays in a sense, like you said, you've invited the demon in somehow. And especially if you think of like The Exorcist, it's like the young woman possessed to do all of these bad things. It's like culture is coming to sort of disintegrate the social order of America. And I think that the Reagan years are so amazing for horror. It's so rich with just like
rich with horror. It's his campaign tagline. Do we want to talk about the difference real quick between ghosts and poltergeists and demons.
Well, poltergeists are like a manifest. I mean, I guess I'm speaking like just generally, like obviously every film is going to do its own thing with it. But like poltergeists are like a manifestation of like a living person. Then there's like ghosts, which are like something, someone that existed in the house before. And then there's like possession, which is about like Satan specifically. So it's not necessarily like a living person who died, but like a malevolent spirit that exists on some other realm. But also like Amityville, isn't the implication that like Jody and the pig outside the window are Satan? Like I was like, I feel like Amityville is like super unclear on its own. Like it's like maybe it's the ghosts of people who died, but maybe it's Satan, but maybe it's also these like restless spirits from like the that were buried there. Like it's like not clear. But yeah, so I feel like it's like Satan or a living person or a dead person. Like that, those are the people that can haunt the space.
And I think depends. Amityville is just like a real bacchanal of like everything they could think of.
Yeah.
So it does, it's like the quintessential, like the house is haunted. It's the house.
Right. The house is just bad. Yeah. Or there's also the idea that like the house is bad, right? Which I feel like is also this idea that like the space, I mean, this is like, I mean, Hill House, right? The idea is that like the house is just born bad. Like there's just something wrong with the space. And it's funny because like in every remake of The Haunting of Hill House, like they, in the horrible version they did with Owen Wilson.
Oh, yeah. We started it and we couldn't finish it.
Oh my God. It's, I remember seeing it as a young person and even then being like, but like that, they gave some like explanation. It's like he murdered children, or they gave some like backstory to the guy who ran the house. But like, you know, I think in the book, just like the idea that the sort of being kicked around is like the house is just like wrong in some like fundamental way. And there's also this, have you ever read The House Next Door by Ann Rivers Seddon? Are you familiar with that book? It's a great haunted house novel. It's very weird because it's like a stealth haunted house novel, because if you look at the cover, it looks like a mid-80s like Southern romance or something. Like the cover is like this pastel. Like it's very unassuming. And it's this terrifying haunted house story from the 70s, like a novel. And the premise is that these young hot, like James Brolin and Margot Kidder are like two very sexy, a young couple living in this like nice house in the sort of like Atlanta like suburbs. And there's a house getting built behind them. And like they spend all day just like doing coke and fucking and like drinking way too much, like way, way, way too much, and watching this house go behind them. And then like people keep moving into the house and like bad things happen to everybody who lives there. And ultimately, like the sort of the reveal is that like the architect who created it is like infected with something weird. And so like when he builds the house, like it builds bad, like it builds sinister. It's one of the scariest. It's really, it's like up there with Hill House for me. It's like a real just like amazing kind of sleeper, brilliant haunted house novel. But yeah, so this idea that then a space can be bad in some way, which is just interesting as well.
The last thing I wanted to ask, and I think it'd be fun if we all answer this question, is do you, Carmen first, believe in ghosts?
No. I do not believe in ghosts. I do believe that like spaces can have emotions, like spaces can hold psychology and hold mood and atmosphere and experiences in interesting ways that I think some of which we've identified through science, some of which we haven't. And I think that like things can be haunted in like sort of a less literal sense. Like, do I believe that like dead spirits exist on some other plane that we can't see? Like, no, I don't think so. You know, in the sense that I also don't believe in like angels or God or demons or whatever. But I do think that like things can be haunted in a lot of ways, just like not exactly in the way that I think maybe that question intends. But like, yeah, I think it's like possible, but I also don't believe in ghosts. So
have you seen a ghost? This is just for me.
No, this is for everyone.
No, I just want to know. I just like to ask people for their ghost stories.
I've never seen a ghost. I will tell you that I did because I also was like a very religious teenager. So there was a point in my life when I was like open to the experiences of like that there were supernatural things that like I could access. And I think it's because I really wanted to see a ghost. I think that's what that was all about. It was like that whole like stint of evangelical Christianity in my teens was like an attempt to like access something bigger than myself.
Yeah.
Whether it's ghosts or God or whatever. And I did have this one experience where I remember like being really close to a tree line. where some kids were playing, and I was just sort of sitting watching them. I was at this like retreat thing, and like for my church, and I remember getting this very weird sense from the tree line and like feeling really like stressed out by it and like feeling like something was about to come out of it and getting really like anxious and feeling really agitated. And then the kids like overshot, like someone threw the ball and someone else missed it, and it like rolled kind of into the trees, and the kids all like went to go grab the ball, and then they like stopped and they both like, they all like jogged away and just like a bit like left it there. Wow. As if they also sent something, and I was just like, and then I kind of got up and went away, and it's like the only time in my life I've ever been like, what the hell was going on? Like, and there was a sense of something else, but like what that was, I have no idea. But no, I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen like a form of something I believed was a ghost. Have you ever seen a ghost?
Miranda, hit it.
Well, okay. So I was also an incredibly anxious, scaredy cat of a child, and I was the most afraid of ghosts. And all through my teenage years and everything, I was terrified of ghosts. And sure, they were real, even when I got a little more logical. And I did have a couple of instances where I thought I saw a ghost. I don't know what it was to this day. But it's interesting. When I was 25, I started taking escitalopram for my anxiety. And I'm not afraid of ghosts anymore. It's the weirdest thing. I was a touring musician for like 8 years, and I couldn't sleep in a room by myself because I was so afraid of what was around me in my 20s. And then I started taking anti-anxiety medication, and that is the one thing that I know it has done, is that I can sleep in a room by myself. I can walk through dark spaces. Although Chelsea and I, we went through a haunted corn maze attraction, and I started crying and had to leave halfway through it. I just bailed through the cast.
We had
entrance.
To sit by the trailer where they do medical things.
And I was sitting there crying, and Chelsea was like, okay, but I'm going to go back in, and then I'm going to go through the second one. Is that okay?
Well, it was clown themed.
Yeah.
So I love haunted attractions. Like, I will go to them every year. They are just my favorite thing in the world.
The best
I love
thing
Halloween
in the world.
Season. Yeah. It's like my favorite.
Same.
It was very hard this past year not to be able to go.
We went through a drive-through haunted corn maze.
Oh my God.
It was bad.
It was bad.
But I'm glad
bad,
it happened.
Bad.
But yeah, so I was living in Iowa City. I was there for grad school, and a bunch of us decided to go to a haunted corn maze that was like an hour away. And it was like me and a friend, and then like these two people that like were new to the program. But like, I didn't know them super well, but they were like, yeah, we want to come. And so we go to this corn maze, and it was like a really good attraction. It was like, when we were in the corn maze, first of all, this young woman had the reaction that you had, which was like, I thought we were going to have to airlift her out of this corn maze, because she like at some point refused to move. And we were like, you have to keep going. Like, we're in the middle of a cornfield. Like, you can't just stop. Like, you can't go back. Like, we have to just keep progressing forward. And she was just having we were like really afraid we were going to have to like call somebody. It was a whole thing. And then there was this part that was like a clown arena. So you like came into this like space, and it was like a big circle. And there were like, you know, insane looking clown monsters with chainsaws. And it was like actual chainsaws with there was no blade on it, but like it was making all the sounds, and like, you know, it smelled like a chainsaw.
It's the scariest thing there is. Yeah.
And so I was like, great. So then there's like on the other side of this like clearing, there's like a flap to go through to the next part. So I'm like, cool. So I like go running down, and you touch it, and it's solid. Like, it's not real. So I was like, it was the closest to like a nightmare manifesting in real life. Cause I was just like, wait, what? And then we were just like, wait, where do we go? And the clouds are going, zoom, zoom. Oh. And we were all just like, what?
Oh my God.
We were like running around trying to find it. And it took us so long that one of the clouds was like, maybe it's over there. Like, gesture with his chainsaw. Because like the next group had to come through, I guess, and he was just like, "You idiots! Like, that's where the flap is." And it was like hidden in this like weird way, but it was like so. Oh my God, it was so funny. But it was really good also, because like the haunted corn mazes are like, they rustle. Like, it's like the setting itself is so terrifying that like you don't.
I
need
love
very
Children
much
of the Corn so much.
I have actually never seen Children of the
Oh my god!
I don't love scary children as a genre. Wow. I don't love it. I just don't find them super terrifying. So I just not a genre that I'm a subgenre that I'm very interested in. But if you recommend it, I'll watch it.
The aesthetic of it is really cool, and something about it is just like God, like right in the pocket. So Chelsea, do you believe in ghosts?
I believe in the possibility of ghosts, but I'm like on the like we already live in a simulation trip, so like there's probably just like something happening where like if every moment is occurring in the same moment and there is no separation of time, then perhaps things are bleeding over. That's what I've been thinking about lately. But I was very into ghosts as a teenager. I job shadowed ghost hunters when I was 16 and went to ghost hunting conferences. And I really wanted to talk to Edna St. Vincent Millay through my... But then I learned she was really mean. She probably would have been mean to me. I didn't know that. I learned that from you. And
she was really mean. Wait,
hard for me.
Wait, but then you did also read that story about how that weird thing happened to me at the Millay Colony, where the other artists thought I was crying in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't me. So that's like a ghost thing that like I was the ghost, but I wasn't because I was asleep. So who knows? That's beautiful, though. I love that.
But yeah, and then it was a lot of like I had so many ghost experiences and I don't know how to explain them, but I was very emotional. I smoked a lot of weed. You know, I don't know. There's a lot of possibilities and it doesn't really happen to me anymore. But my dad and my mom both like hardcore believe in everything. So it was colored by that,
too.
Certainly. But yeah, I've definitely got a lot.
Were you very religious?
No,
like,
not at all.
Did you believe in like that sort of thing?
Oh, nope, not at all. There wasn't a religion thing at all, which is nice because it was kind of pure in that way. Like it was fun. I was never scared of ghosts. I was an only child. And I think, you know, you can invent sort of entities for sure as a way to, I don't know, probably express things. I don't really know. It definitely wasn't a ghost. Like it wasn't a dead person. My granny's house is haunted by a dead person, we think, but that's I'll tell it really quick. She woke up one time. She has a grandmother clock. She's British.
It's a grandmother clock.
They've always called it a grandmother clock. If I'm wrong, that's embarrassing. But anyway, she like shot up in bed and it was midnight and she heard somebody yelling at each chime of this grandmother clock. So like it would like one, and is it like, you know, whatever, as it rang out, exactly, it'd be like one, two, all the way up to 12.
What?
Dude, yeah. And then it stopped, and then she's screaming for my grandfather, who just couldn't hear a damn thing by then. And so yeah, and that's not the, like, things have slid on the table, like glasses have just kind of broke for no reason. Like it's a very, and somebody did die in the house who had really serious issues toward the end that were, we've done a lot of research trying to figure it out, but we haven't figured out much. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what I believe in. I honestly have no idea how to explain that because my granny's not somebody who is like ready to believe in ghosts. You know what I mean? She's not somebody who that would manifest to because she's susceptible to it already. So it's a mystery. But yeah, ghosts have been a huge part of my life forever. And I love everything about them. I'm just more interested in like the psychological side of the paranormal now.
I think I have one more thing to say about a haunting.
Please.
Something occurred to me as you were talking. I was thinking about my own home. And like, so we just moved into this house, not last year, but the year before. And it's in West Philadelphia. And it's like about 100 years old, roughly, more or less. And the woman who lived here, I'm pretty sure, died here. I mean, she was like very old. And the house has like very good energy. And we've never like had any sort of, you know, feelings about that sort of thing. But I remember like right after we moved in, we were like painting the bedroom. And I was opening the windows so that we could like get some air in the room. And I leaned out the window and there was this like petrified piece of bread tucked in the windowsill, like on the outside. And I was looking at it and I was like, what is this? And then I realized that she probably put it there so the birds would come to the window. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty sure the room that is our bedroom was her bedroom and that she was summoning birds to the window with this like little piece of bread. Huh. And I feel like that's a haunting. And like, I got to see, like, this little piece of her, you know, in this, like, weird moment where, like, I was suddenly kind of like, communing with the past in this, like, interesting way. And that, to me, feels like something.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of why I love abandoned houses so much, like the real kind, because the artifacts there, it's anthropology, and it does feel like history is presenting itself to you in a way that is really meaningful. Yeah. So that was a beautiful story.
Oh, thank you.
Birds.
We love birds.
Oh, we also we're a big bird house. And a lot of identifying of the birds, naming of the birds. We have a cardinal pair we call Guy Fieri and Lady Fieri.
Yes.
That come to our little theater.
I love them.
Well, you know, I think our haunted thing recently was we found
a yearbook.
Yearbook on the ground from 1970.
Yeah.
From New Mexico.
On the ground outside?
On the ground outside behind a garbage can. I was like, what's this big orange book? And I kicked it over and it was a fucking yearbook from 1970. And we were able to go through and sort of be like, okay, so here's prom queen. It sounds like prom queen was dating him. And we kind of created the entire social scene of this mysterious 1970 yearbook that I found on the ground from New Mexico.
Wait, where do you guys live?
In Seattle.
In Seattle.
So it was a little ghostly.
You can check out our Instagram stories for that. It's in our highlights.
It was the best thing that happened.
I feel like, wasn't there recently this thing where like somebody found an In-N-Out, as before COVID, someone found like an In-N-Out burger in like New York or something, like on the ground, and they and like the nearest In-N-Out is like 2,000 miles away. And
there was like, that's so fun.
There was like this weird quest. I can't remember what publication it was in, and it was just like, where did the, and it was like perfectly preserved, just like sitting on the ground, and they were like, where did this come from?
A haunted burger. I love
things
it.
That just are where they shouldn't be.
Yes, that's a haunting.
Dude, back on my granny trip, she freaking found a wrapper from England of like a candy wrapper that her father used to eat who died in England, and she found it in like a plant that she commonly watered.
What?
That was like not from there at all. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know about that.
Dude, I didn't tell you that one?
I
yeah.
Don't think
that's
so.
Wild.
Yeah. So I don't know. And that one's particular to somebody who's gone. And that's a different thing, too. Like our own dead, right? The people we miss communicating with us. That's in a positive way, because that's a ghost, too, right? We just think of we're talking about hauntings, not sort of the reassurances of the people who've passed on, or at least what we manifest about them.
Oh,
Carmen. Jesus. This was so much fun. I think all three of us could talk about this for the rest of our lives. So.
Yeah, seriously. I was like, you want to go for another 5 hours?
Let's set up a weekly meeting.
Well, any other time you want me to talk about anything, I would love to. This is great. This was so much fun.
We will.
Thank you so much, Carmen, for being here. And we can't wait to talk to you again.
Be careful out there. This was American Hysteria. Please, please, oh dear God, please get your hands on Carmen's books, In the Dream House, Her Body and Other Parties, and The Low, Low Woods. Baby, you deserve it. Next time on the show, we've got part two of our horror series that covers teenage slashers, satanic possessions, the torture movies that shocked a post-9/11 America, and the social thrillers of today and the legacy that helped create them. If you can, consider becoming a patron for our other bi-weekly podcast, early episodes, and access to a video of our two-hour vaudevillian live show featuring everything from a tinky-winky drag performance to a live consumption of Pop Rocks and Coke, skits, dance, Alex Jones, and much, much more. Follow us on social media at AmerHysteria on Twitter and at American Hysteria Podcast on Instagram. And if you can, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This episode has sound by Clear Camo Studios and was produced and co-hosted by Miranda Zickler. Thanks as always for listening. And may you channel all of the fright of the last year into the good ghost you need, whatever form it may take. Have a great week.